Hello, everyone. This is your host, Ron Way, for Author Talk and Rising Light Media Group. Today, I have a great pleasure of introducing you to a new author to me. His name is Ken Evers Hood, and he has written a fascinating new book entitled The Irrational Jesus. There's also a subtitle, but we'll get to that in a minute. Ken graduated from Princeton Theological Seminary and earned his doctorate from Duke Divinity School. He's currently a pastor at Tualatin. See, I said that right, didn't I, Ken?
Yes, you did.
It's Presbyterian Church near Portland, Oregon. Welcome, Ken, to Author Talk. I'm glad that you could join me today.
Thanks so much, Ron. Great to be here.
Before we jump into your book, Ken, take a moment to tell us, all of us that are listening, a little bit about yourself. Take us on a short trip down the path that's led you to this point in your life.
Absolutely. I felt a call to ministry when I was an undergraduate in the University of Texas at Austin, where I met my wife. And we wound up going to Princeton. I thought I would be interested in academics and teaching and whatnot, but, you know, I love people. And so I've been, started out in new church development outside of Austin, and then I've been a pastor for, gosh, I've been here at Tualatin for 14 years, and we've got three amazing kids, and that's me in a small nutshell.
What did you do before you were, did you come right out of divinity and go into pastoring?
I went right out, yeah.
You couldn't get a job, huh?
They always say that you're supposed to know what you're doing, you know, when you're a new church developer, and it was the first thing I did, and I knew nothing, and I found that very helpful. We knew how to make mistakes, and we made them gloriously, and that church, Presbyterian Church of Lake Travis, is thriving today.
That's great. You got from the East Coast to the West Coast. How did that happen?
Yeah, we had our first child, William Chester. He goes by Chess, and we were away from family. My folks were in Dallas-Fort Worth, and her folks lived out here, and we thought, well, we need to be close to them, and the decision between Dallas-Fort Worth and Portland, Oregon, Ron,
yeah,
that was not a hard one to make.
No, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that. It's a beautiful, beautiful place to live. When you started to ministering, did you start out as an assistant minister? Did you go straight on up, or how did that work for you in your own career?
Yeah, no, I just started right out in new church development.
Wow.
And my job was to start a congregation, and we had a handful of people in the hills of Austin, and we wound up learning together, and they gave me an incredible start in ministry. When I came out here, I'm a pastor of a mid-sized congregation, and a lot of my learning isn't just at this church, but I served on our larger presbytery board and worked with pastors and churches in conflict, and that's where a lot of the work in this book came from, is working with folks trying to, you know, learn how to be together.
Yeah, I read that in your book you were giving, and it's a great book for anyone in a church, because you do have conflicts. You have the people that are the big donors that tend to hold sway, and you're afraid to, on many occasions, to ruffle their feathers. But if you don't take into account the average bloke in the congregation, you run into trouble. And you wrote about that.
Yeah, that's right. I would say the impetus for this book for me and my research at Duke, it came from, you know, being a pastor and loving theology. I was a classics major and studied Greek and Latin, and I love all of that. But I also discovered a really huge disjunct between the theological work that I did, and then working with real human beings, Ron. They're very different.
Absolutely.
And part of how I got hooked up into working with Dan Ariely at Duke is he's a behavioral economist, and what they do is they take these beautiful economic models of how people should behave, and then Dan does these clever experiments to see if people, real people, actually behave that way, and of course we don't. And I thought, that's precisely what I experience in the church. Of we have these beautiful theological ideas or models of how we should behave, but every pastor knows, or anybody who's sat on a church board knows, real human beings are very different, and often predictably so. So that's the good news.
Well, that leads me to your subtitle of your book. You said, and the first question I have, because as I mentioned to you when we were prepping for this, that my prime interest is in the historical Jesus, which I love to study, and the early years of Christianity, our formative years. And you had some fascinating observations for me. You had mentioned that Jesus, and I'm going to quote, had a limited ability to see the future. He had a physical limitations and a remarkable lack of self-interest. And in his full humanity, Jesus is limited by time and place, by imperfect information. And for me, this is a powerful concept, because we tend to mush that over, the Jesus that really walked and started this whole change and mankind. And you quote one of my favorite authors, who I've had on the show a couple of times as a guest, Amy Jill Levine. Yes. And she writes that, I'm going to quote her and then I'm going to quote your book. Quote, Jesus of Nazareth dressed like a Jew, prayed like a Jew, instructed other Jews on how best to live according to the commandments given by God to Moses, taught like a Jew, argued like a Jew with other Jews, and died like thousands of other Jews on a Roman cross. Now, may I quote from your own book?
Absolutely.
Here we go. To give us a clear outline of where we're headed, irrationality in Jesus's life falls into four major categories. The presence of a strong emotion in Jesus's life, the limited knowledge Jesus possesses, the mistakes Jesus makes in the Gospels, and the adaptive behaviors Jesus employs that are consistent with the actions behavioral theorists would expect of human subjects in cognitive limitations. I want to take these one at a time, if you'll allow me. Would that be all right?
You bet.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about Jesus's strong emotions and even anger.
Absolutely, Ron. As a Presbyterian, I'm actually a pretty orthodox guy. I believe in Chalcedon and the council there that said Jesus is fully divine and fully human. And I think we do a great job on the divinity, and we've done a pretty terrible job historically on the humanity. The powerful emotion that Jesus experiences. You know, the cover of the book has Giotto's depiction of Jesus cleansing the temple. And the reason I picked Giotto, he was early Renaissance, and he shows Jesus with emotion. He's ticked off looking, Ron, which if you look in past depictions, he looks, you know, really happy and kind of passive, and there's no emotion at all. I think it's absurd to think that Jesus, when he cleansed the temple, did so in some sort of impassive way. I mean, he felt rage and righteous indignation when he healed people.
Can I mention one thing on that point? It just ticked a memory. I belong to Westar, which is made up of a couple of hundred biblical scholars. And I sat on the board for about 10 years before I got tired of nonprofits. You're stuck with them. I wasn't. And I left that job. But one of the first times I went to one of these sessions, and there were maybe 40, 50 scholars around, and they were at tables. They had all their research papers, and they were expounding on their theories about the historical Jesus, which was all wonderful. But they got to this exact story, the temple cleansing. And as they started talking, it was so pacific. It was so academic. It was so clinical, so clean. And I, honest to God, I wanted to just stand up without any notice, walk up to the nearest table, which they had papers and books and their coffee cups, and just flip the table over and walk out of the room. Because they were postulating that if Jesus had done that, he couldn't have got 20 feet before the temple guards would have arrested him. But my point was, yes, he could have. He was infuriated, and he flipped it over. It caused such a commotion, birds flying, lambs bleeding, and he could have just walked right out, and no one would have. It's the shock value. And you're talking about those emotions that he had, and you're absolutely right. Especially some of the Catholic pictures of him looking up to heaven, and he's so sweet, you know?
Right. Yeah, and I think that betrays our what I call practical docetism, where nobody that I know believes in docetism or which comes from the Greek word dokeo, or to seem, that Jesus isn't really human, he just seems to be. We say that we don't believe that, but practically, almost everybody I know, Ron, is a practical docetist. They don't take Jesus' humanity seriously enough.
That's right. It's, you know, it's a hypothetical, or it's theoretically he was, you know, he was human. Oh, but he is divine. But how can that be? How can that be? He was a real human being, or he would have been a god. And if he was God at that moment, you know, we aren't. So what good would it have done us? We couldn't emulate the man.
Exactly. What it, you know, to go on with the emotion, it isn't just the righteous indignation, but when he heals, it's one of my favorite words in Greek. Often it gets translated as moved with pity, which I think is a pretty weak translation, but splagnizomai. And splagnizomai, it's a Homeric word. It's an ancient word. And it means to be moved in your bowels, moved in your guts. So when he sees somebody, you know, that is in need of healing, it isn't just this robotic action of kindness. He's moved in this deep and human way. And then, I mean, everybody's, you know, favorite shortest verse they say, when Lazarus dies, and Mary says, "Lord, had you been here, our brother wouldn't have died." And Jesus wept. You know, he weeps. Certainly, in the Garden of Gethsemane, there is just this powerful affliction of emotion, and the cry of dereliction on the cross. I've actually heard some people say, "Well, you know, it's just the beginning of a psalm that ends really nicely."
Yeah,
and I'm like, "Come on, my God, why have you forsaken me?"
There you go.
That is just cry it out.
Absolutely, absolute despair. Because if he didn't, he wouldn't know what we're like, would he?
I think that's absolutely right.
Let's go on next. Jesus had limited knowledge. We're in trouble here. Come on, talk to me.
Well, you know, limited knowledge. I mean, there are some small ways that you see that, like when the woman with the hemorrhage reaches out and touches him, and he says, "Who touched me?" And the disciples say, "You know, how can we know?" I mean, that to me is I think we can allow for someone to not know something small like that. But to me, what's fascinating is when they ask him about the kingdom. When is the kingdom going to come? You know, his response, he's consistent on this, and I have no idea how cults who predict the end stay in business, because he's consistent. He says, "Nobody, not even the Son of Man, knows the time or the day." And he doesn't say, "Hey, I know it, I'm just not telling you." He doesn't know it. To not know, that to me, that's a massive amount of ignorance for Jesus, and something that I think we should take seriously.
Absolutely. I mean, people think that if he is the Messiah, of course he knew. But that that isn't what the New Testament says. That isn't what the Gospels say. They're reporting stories they've heard, and they wouldn't put it in there if they thought it was bad. It's just the way it was.
Right, right. And, you know, and tacked on to that, to me, is the mistakes that he appears to make. And I think if when I present this to groups, particularly church people, this is where people get the most nervous. But along with his limited knowledge, you know, Jesus makes he makes mistakes. There's a time when the Pharisees accuse him of breaking the Sabbath, and he likens himself to David. He said, in the days of Abiathar, when Abiathar was priest. But the problem is, Abiathar wasn't priest. It's actually Ahimelech. Now, it's possible that some sleepy monk, when he was transcribing that, you know, made an error, but there's no textual evidence for that at all. To me, the clear reading is that Jesus just confused the names. I think that's okay.
Well, I'll tell you another one that you have in your book that's always been a favorite on many levels, and it confounds many Christians, is the story in Mark about the conversation that Jesus had with the woman in Tyre, who is a Gentile. That's a non-Jew, folks, like you and me, probably. A couple of things roll around in our minds when we hear this. Most Christians are just like the woman. We're Gentiles. And Jesus teaches love to all. Why would he refer to the woman as a dog, which is really an insult, who didn't deserve any scraps from his table? And he says that his healing, his wisdom, his teaching was reserved only for his kind. Jews? That story, although explained away by many Christians, and I've heard of many different explanations, you've heard more, is still uncomfortable and shows a very human man changing his mind. Talk to us about that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Ron, I think if there's no other story for me that really highlights Jesus' full humanity than that. As I read it as a pastor, he's trying to go on vacation.
You're right.
He's tired.
You're
you know,
right.
I like to go to the beach, but Jesus goes to Syria. Why not? When he's there, this woman breaks in on him. There's something that behavioralists call decision fatigue, and we know that throughout the day, as we become more and more tired, we become more conservative in our judgments. There's an amazing Israeli parole board study where about 70% of the releasing of prisoners occurs before noon. And so we'd like to think of people as being objective, and especially judges. But the reality is, it's when in the morning we're at our best. Well, Jesus was not at his best, right? He's on vacation, he's tired, and then here this woman barges in, and he spits an epithet at her dog. Now, so there are some people who will say things like, well, they use tois kunarios, which is the diminutive. It's just a puppy, so you know maybe he's being cute. I think that's absurd. I think he's being rude. I think he's being racist. I think what he's saying is awful because he's tired, and in his full humanity, he makes mistakes. What's amazing about the story is the woman, of course, you know, comes right back at him and says, oh, but sir, even the dogs under the table get the scraps. And he says, for saying that, your daughter has been made well. So what I think is remarkable about Jesus isn't that he makes the mistake. He does that. But it's that when she comes back at him, he's able to own the mistake and then change his mind. And I think that's redeeming.
Well, it's an interesting thing. If we were alive during his life, we have to realize he really did come to Israelites. He didn't come for the Gentiles. He was speaking their language. It's
yeah.
Like Amy Jill said in the beginning, he spoke like a Jew. He spoke just to Jews primarily, but that's who he came to talk to. And it wasn't until much later, which is kind of a segue for me, because we've got, believe it or not, we've got 3/4 of our time. It goes
yeah.
that fast. But I want you to talk to another favorite character of mine, and that's the Apostle Paul. Because you, part of your book, you talk about the formative years of Christianity and Apostle Paul. And you spend some time talking about Paul the tent maker in Corinth, but you talk about the games and how we should look at Paul and his teachings. And I found that fascinating. I never read that before. So give us a history lesson.
Absolutely. I think it's pretty famous that Paul's known as a tent maker, but people had homes. They had domi in Roman Corinth. They knew how to do that. So why on earth was he making tents? So the games, the athletic games, were an enormous part of the ancient world. And the Isthmian games, which occurred in the isthmus of Corinth, they went every 2 years after the Olympic games. So just like we have the Summer Olympics and then 2 years later the Winter Olympics, they had the Olympic Olympics, and then 2 years later, the Isthmian Games. And that's where Paul made tents. And the language of gaming and gamefulness, it infiltrates Paul's words. So he talks about running the race. He talks about disciples being like athletes that are playing according to the rules. And, you know, where I go into it, one of the things that behavioralists use games for is to show how we are predictably irrational. And so the game that I use with Paul particularly is called the Prisoner's Dilemma, and it's a game where it would be best if both participants would cooperate with each other, but there's a temptation to defect. Now, the rational way to play that game, and you could learn more in the book about this, but John Nash, A Beautiful Mind, he'd say the rational way to play is to never cooperate with your partner. always defect. Fortunately, when we study real human beings, irrational human beings, we cooperate all the time. So what I think happens with Paul as he's developing churches is they are in a kind of prisoner's dilemma, where Paul is wanting to shape them in a way that's incredibly countercultural for the day, and then the folks in there, you know, while they do want to be in these churches, there are times when they want to push back. So if, for instance, you know, on that one is certainly the Corinthian correspondence, and take the Lord's table, for example, you know, Paul is envisioning an incredibly countercultural meal where poor and wealthy come together and enjoy the same food, and of course, what happens is the wealthy
and Christian and Jews.
Yeah, and right, Christians, Jews. Well, particularly wealthy and poor, I think, is, mm-hmm. is really striking. But because the wealthy show up, they eat all the food, they drink all the wine, and then when the poor are able to finally get off work and arrive, all they find are fat, drunk Christians. It's not pretty. And that's why Paul says, when you eat and drink like that, you eat and drink to your destruction. It's not a moral judgment, you know, about some sort of personal sin. It's this corporate sin of the people defecting against them. You know, I'm going on a little bit, but there was a guy, Robert Axelrod, who studied the repeated prisoner's dilemma, and the strategy, the pattern that was the most successful, he thought it would be mean and long and difficult. It was the kindest and the simplest, and it's called tit for tat, and it means you are always starting with trust. You're always wanting to cooperate, but then it's tough. So it will push back when somebody pushes back against you. But then it always moves to forgiveness, and it's entirely consistent. And I would say, you know, if anything Paul is consistent about, it is this pattern of he's often trusting, he's developing these communities, then he's leaving.
Right.
Then when they defect, he pushes back. He writes angry letters. In Galatians, he omits the Thanksgiving section. He can push back. But then he's often exhibiting forgiveness, and then he's doing this consistently throughout his life. And I think that's why you know, the church, the early church, thrived and flourished.
Absolutely. I mean, we really owe our Christianity today to Paul. If it wasn't for Paul, we probably wouldn't have what we have today, because after the Roman War, there was very few of the early Christians, certainly not in Jerusalem. They would have been killed or hauled off into slavery.
And Gentiles like you and me, we wouldn't be talking about this.
No, not at all. And I have to be the bearer of bad news.
Yep.
We've completely run out of time. But you can see now, everyone listening will have to buy your book and finish your story for themselves.
Awesome.
Yeah. Folks, Ken Evers-Hood's book is not just about Jesus, but about all Christian life within the church. And it's a wonderful story about how we look at Jesus, how we look at our fellow members of our congregations. It's a story about getting along. The book is named The Irrational Jesus, Leading the Fully Human Church. I want to take this time, Ken, to thank you so much for being on Author Talk, being our guest. I had a ball speaking to you today, and I wish you all the luck in the world.
Ron, thank you. It was a pleasure.
While you're on the Author Talk website listening to this, all you have to do is click on the cover of the book next to the interview that you're listening to, and it'll take you straight to Amazon where you can order Ken's book. Ken, I hope they do order by the hundreds.
Me too, Ron.
For now, this is your host, Ron Way, wishing you all the best. Until we meet again, I remain faithfully yours.